शिला गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री हरिनाम संकीर्तन की जय, श्री श्री दौजी गोपाल जी की जय, श्री एकादशी व्रत की जय, गौर भक्त वृंद की जय, गौर प्रमान हरि हरि प्रणाम टू ऑल, गुड इवनिंग, वेलकम as well as to those connected online. We are again meeting each other for Ista Gosti, or trying to nourish and enlighten one another by mutual exchange of trust, confidence and humility, as Krishna mandates in the Gita. Pranipat pariprasna siva, trying to surrender, trying to inquire, trying to serve, and of course this is not only on one of the parts, and the other part is taking advantage of that, if you will, but no, both the one who is making the question, both the one who is answering, are together trying to help each other into increasing the surrender of their presentation, if you will, and trying to make of their individual selves a fitting offering for the pleasure of Bhagavan. So it's, as our Guru Maharaj always says, it's at least 50%, 50% among the inquirer and the replier, if you will. So it's a very beautiful and dependent exchange of sadhu sangha, which in the two parties acknowledge how much they depend on each other. Because no matter how much we can emphasize personal effort in the path, which of course is a fact, at the same time we are individuals who work in environments. I mean, you take out the environment and we have no more individuality. We are individuals because of the environment that somehow supports and confirms our individuality. Whether it may be the environment, there will be a corresponding sense of identity. But you take all environment and you take basically all identity. So this is a particular environment which tries to foster a particular sense of identity in each of us, that of a sevaka, which is a very important sense of identity to develop. I am a unit of dedication, basically a dedicated unit for the pleasure of the higher realms. That's who I am. So that's the potential the most bright potential that accompanies us. We are dedicating units. So how I can apply myself in the proper environment, as Guru Maharaj said the other day, how can I organize the most possible favorable circumstances that may promote this type of sense of identity? And in the context of that favorable environment that I've tried to recreate around me, of course I will welcome all the things that I have to tolerate and deal with, because that will be still there. It's not that the most perfect environment that I can make is that one where I won't be challenged at any point. That will be the closest idea to hell, basically, not to heaven. So that's what we want. So part of this interaction is a healthy sense of challenge. In a humble way, it's an interesting way of trying to combine these two ideas, humility and challenge, humble challenge. Because generally here, he spoke in a challenging spirit, so we think, oh, that's not humble. But actually, if someone is really humble, that's really challenging. If you're in front of someone who is humble, actual humble person, inquiring in a humble way, with sincerity, with full dignity and integrity. I mean, if you are asking from that side to me, for me, that's a challenge, because I can only reply up to that circumstance. I mean, I have to rise myself to the occasion if I am to speak the same language with you. So that's a very, again, beautiful challenge. It's a humble one. It's a one challenge that fosters humility, in another word, a challenge that fosters against Sharanagati and the service spirit. Those are the challenges that we don't want to avoid, basically. We don't want just to to embrace any challenge for the sake of tolerating, as Guru Maharaj say, the most torturous situation. It's not about that being masochist or something. But those challenges that will foster all these ingredients that will help us to be all that we can be, hopefully we are ready for that, because that's what will make give meaning to our days, basically. Mm-hmm. Especially staying in a place like this. So, that's it. With that introduction, I hope you have 108 questions. You may have to challenge me, probably, hopefully. So I don't know if there are any inquiries or topics you may like to hear about, to inquire about. Who rose the hand first? I mean, we will entertain the two of them. No gambling. No. joking. Okay, let's go with Zach first.
Yeah, I was just wanting to ask a question about...
But you told me you have no question today. Yeah. Someone came up after that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just now.
Oh, great. That's the idea.
Challenge.
Great. Sorry, yeah.
I guess my question's about just pride.
Pride?
Yeah, pride.
Uh-huh.
And how... pride can manifest or take its form inside the self,
mm-hmm.
and how to see that happening inside the self and kind of maybe change or just provide just a way to see that and.
Yeah. So, so how to then detect and deal with pride as it somehow expresses itself in our journey, if you will. So, of course, that's an important question for sure, because. As all of us have been speaking these days and hearing, humility is totally, basically a synonym with bhakti. So if humility is synonym with bhakti, and we are here trying to practice bhakti, we hopefully are willing to take distance from those things that are diametrically opposed to all that bhakti means. And if humility is synonym with bhakti, the exact nemesis of humility is the exact nemesis of bhakti, and pride is basically that feature, basically that at heart contradicts with all that we want to become. So it could be seen as a, in one sense, as the most unbecoming reality that a bhakta will want to accept or to keep fostering in the name of bhakti, which is the most undesirable thing. No, because one thing is to, okay, I have pride and I'm acquiring further pride, that's not nice. I have pride, I'm not working on that, that's even less nice. But I have pride and I masquerade that and put tilak and sika and it presents like a devotee and I try to hide something like pride in the name of, or using bhakti for promoting something that basically is suffocating bhakti. So that's the last thing we would like to do. Mm. But the point is that those things can happen. That's why we are mentioning them. I don't think you are hearing me and saying, Maharaj, what are you saying? What are you speaking about? That doesn't exist at all. No, no. I mean, if you think that doesn't exist at all, I respect your naivete, but to be realistic, we are not in Golok Vrindavan yet. So if we will be in Golok Vrindavan, we wouldn't even make in the question to begin with, because there is no place to conceive such a possibility. The only option there is Swarup Shakti and so on. But if we ask the question, it's because we know we have another option and we have chosen that option enough times as to... be more familiar with that option than with the other one, even. In one sense, we are more acquainted with the realm of pride than with the realm of humility in many cases. And we are not afraid to enter into the plane of pride and to move in a very expert way, like I have my PhD there, so I know what to do, what to say, how to behave according to pride standards. But when someone invites me to enter the humility room, I start to tremble maybe. Because it's like jumping into the unknown. Because I'm so little acquainted with the reality of being humble that all that it implies may give panic even. So it may be easier to go to that which already we know. Explore territory, if we will. Sometimes that's how it works in our psychology. You know, we feel everything is in order when I remain in touch with explored territory. No? Because I know what will I find in this corner, behind this, below here, up in this, and all this. Yeah, I know. I have explored the territory. I know what will happen in any given situation. Of course, very subtly, the notion is I'm in control. And all this is tied to the idea of pride. And the opposite to order, that sometimes we may call it chaos or some other word, it's not necessarily something that is totally traumatic and the worst possible thing on earth, but just simply some things that appear out of that explored territory, which somehow reside in us, maybe in a subconscious way, and when exposed in a particular environment, those things like pew, starts to manifest. And of course, if you are willing to embrace those hidden sides voluntarily, most probably we will be able to deal with that in a more organic way than if you are unwilling to recognize that, and nonetheless that will somehow appear at some moment and will take you by surprise and you may feel like you are dying, literally. Because it's totally unexpected, it's totally out of your comfort zone, totally out of your control. And you subjectively feel I'm being devoured by this, like, vortex or something. And humility can be felt like that, interestingly, no? When we hear and feel humility such a beautiful thing and virtue, and it is, but the more we are not, again, willing to get further acquainted with that reality, we will experience those beautiful things as monsters yet. Because of those other monsters we have not dealt yet in our own self, pride being maybe one of the most prominent ones. And of course, pride takes different forms. No, it's not pride just something grotesque that here I am, I am the center, surrender to me, I'm the best of the world, and something like extremely obvious and overt. No, it can be so subtle, and that's why it's so dangerous, basically, so unbecoming for the path of bhakti. Srila Raghunath Das Goswami has compared this type of tendencies he has given in his Manas Shikshamari, like very graphic depictions, no? Like being bathed in the ass, in the urine of an ass, or the desire for prestige is like a dog eater woman dancing in my heart. Like a crazy lady dancing in my heart who just wants position and recognition. And sometimes our acharya have depicted these tendencies in a rather, demonic way or something. So it's with a purpose, and of course they have used the language of the times and the graphic symbology that was generally invoked in our tradition in those times, in those places, and maybe in our present times we can of course take advantage from those images, but also we may also need to depict them in ways that also are sustainable for us, because while we recognize the gravity you say of pride, at the same time because of the of such level of gravity, you have to recognize that it won't be easy to overcome that from one day to another. So immediately you have to recognize, okay, how do I on one side recognize that this is one of the worst possible things that could be happening. But simultaneously, since it's one of the worst possible things, it means one of the most difficult to transcend. It means one of the things that will accompany me for the longer time. And therefore, I need to know how to coexist with that in a healthy way till that person is invited to live forever from my heart. And that may take time. So how can I, as Guru Maharaj said the other day, in that case, we have to become psychologically balanced, and our psychological ego has to be balanced enough so we can work on it to eventually transcend it. So it may seem contradictory. I'm trying to transcend something, but before transcending that, I need to befriend that entity, if you will. I need to make peace with that reality for eventually being able to transcend. So something in that connection can be applied to the idea of pride, which is on one side something unfavorable for bhakti, but something not that easy to transcend. At least not that easy to transcend in all its almost unlimited layers. Because that's the tricky thing with pride. No? That in transcending pride, you can increase your pride because you can feel pride. You overcome some test. Oh, I transcended that. And immediately you go back. Because we are not able to realize, okay, maybe I have passed one test, but now I'm ready for the next one, which is a much more refined level of pride, and a much more refined level of pride, and a much more refined, and those much more refined levels of pride, I don't have a clue what they are about in the beginning. I don't have a clue, because it's too remote of a reality yet. It's too covered below layers and layers of other expressions of that same principle. So first, and it's okay. I mean, I don't need to go paranoid about how many layers must be there, and I don't know how much it will take, and I'm full of pride, and you over-identify with that stuff, and you get totally neurotic. Nobody's saying that. But yes, taking a stance in which you can play the game, if you will, in a sustainable way. Not that you think you overcome that in one weekend, in one visit to Madhavan, but also, again, not over-identifying with that to the point that you are thinking more about that than about what you actually are. So, so of course, how to deal with that? First of all, of course, we have to acknowledge that the reality of pride is there. And we have to be open to those realities taking different forms again. There's a lot of elasticity in our anarthas. They update each other on a daily basis in different ways. It's not that they always remain the same. So you idealize, okay, this is anger, this is lust, this is how envy looks, this is how greed works, this is how pride operates, this is the discourse, the narrative of whatever an art in my head. Yeah, on one level it may be like that, but you pass to the next level, and those same entities, or whatever name you want to, elements, will approach you with another narrative, a more updated one. So you get rise to the occasion, so you can detect them in their new presentation. I mean, strictly speaking, they are helping you, technically speaking, because they are forcing you to pay more close attention, forcing us to delve in a more refined way. No, as Mahaprabhu asked Ramananda Roy, that's a very nice, I always like that dynamic of exchange in the Ramananda Sambhad. Of course, the topic was a different one, but the nature of the exchange is very similar to what it means to have a guru and to progress spiritually. And Mahaprabhu himself, speaking with Ramananda will present some idea. Mahaprabhu will say, that's superficial, go deeper. Augment that truth, basically. He's not rejecting that totally, but he's just pointing, considering all that is to be said, that's a superficial consideration yet. So, progress, continue, come on. Not chastising the other person, but like lovingly pushing, huh? that's superficial. You can do more. Go deeper, go deeper. And next one, that's superficial. Go deeper, go deeper. So again, not in a neurotic way, but in a healthy way. And we can feel happy whenever we had the chance to make some progress by the grace of Krishna Guru Gauranga. But yeah, we should be, especially with pride, we should be careful of not like, okay, now I got to know what's pride, and I've dealt with that. I think I'm more humble now. And you kind of relax. No? As we say the other day, relax and then relapse. No? So again, pride will appear in thousands of ways. I mean, you name it. No? I mean, according to the stage we are, I will say that the pride will come in a particular, like, packaging, if you will, no? Concerning our particular situation, and each one is very individual. I cannot tell you how pride will come in one same way to all of you, because it won't happen like that. But you should know it's coming. And that's an important point. It's not that you wake up today as if pride doesn't exist in my life. That wouldn't be sober. No? You wake up, have your shower, continue your day as if pride is some reality that is over there in someone else's mind. Who knows? I mean, if you do not care to investigate in that direction, it means most probably you have like surrendered to the pride you have. I mean, you are really humble, if you will, to your pride, something like this. No? Of course, a false type of humility. No? That's not humility at all. So, but it's possible. It's possible that there, and many times, a very, very nice ways to see where we are standing in terms of pride is in our relationships with others. That gives us a very important bigger picture of who we are or where we are than if we just try to analyze ourselves and our situation on our own terms. That can be really misleading, because we are not isolated entities. Again, we exist in conjunction with a particular environment. So it's good to see ourselves like on the backdrop of that environment and how we react and we function in that environment. Because again, as I always like to say, it's easy to say Trinada Pisunichena Torora Pisagishnunaman Namanadena while chanting japa in your room, only yourself with one incense there, and everything is calm and nice, and I'm more humble than a blade of grass, I'm more tolerant than it, but you are not tolerating anything probably. And you don't have nobody like pinching your ego, taking out of it. Everything is calm and nice. Oh, it seems I've realized third verse of Sikshastaka. But then you put your japa big down and you wake up and let's see how you walk the talk. No, then. And you go out the japa room and some devotee did something you didn't like and immediately like Ravana, Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu, all the parade of asuras, one after the other, are like, my turn. So it's, and we land of reality. I'm being a little bit like sarcastic to just, we laugh and don't cry, but that's the situation, basically. I mean, one of the items of pride is, I don't want people telling me what to do. I don't like. I mean, I should like, but that's how pride will. And immediately we depict the other person as an enemy. We'll put that filter. No? I'm being attacked. Subjectively, emotionally, you will perceive like that. No? That person says something I didn't like. You are not humbly asking why I feel an attack, why I don't like. It's actually the other person, what's making me feel. That's humility when you are really questioning yourself. But pride generally is not willing to enter in that level of detail, but it's mostly like in some form of paranoia, basically, because pride means you are trying to maintain and protect a false personality, a false sense of position, that I am the center, I am the controller, and the problem is that the person next to you probably is thinking the same, or at least struggling with the same thing, no? Because here we are hopefully not thinking like that, but we are struggling with that thinking. So sometimes we may clash. No? Sometimes we may have again, sunny days or cloudy days in that regard. No? Sometimes one is struggling with that and someone also there, they get closer and you put the two pieces of wood together and some sparks start to come. And again, I'm not saying that as to be... I mean, it's important that we realize those things happen, especially in community. And community is not easy at all. It's not a... But it's very, very healthy. You know? I mean, I've lived in community for 20 years already. And I can tell you, I mean, I was put out of my comfort zone so many times. But every time I that happened, in the moment many times that felt like poison, basically. Like dying. And now you can empathize with Arjuna, where Krishna is asking him, do this, do that. In other words, go against your ego. And Arjuna says, I prefer that they kill me rather than following your instruction. It feels like the worst possible type of death, the most bitter pill to swallow what you are asking me. No, thank you. I prefer being pierced by one arrow after another, like Bhishma and more. I prefer that death, that having to enter into that bed of nails that you are suggesting me, Gurudev. But that's how the Gita begins, interestingly. And Arjuna is in denial. He's not willing to accept. And of course, that's not Arjuna, that's us. So again, pride is not necessarily an overt exhibition of I am unique and the best of all of you. Of course, that can happen also. But it also plays itself out in the form of like some whimsical attachment to insist on something that goes against reality, basically. On a sense of self that is hijacking reality, hijacking myself, hijacking my environment. So, of course, if I'm a hijacker, don't be surprised if the whole environment will attack that. Not attack, but will move in some way that you will feel this attacking me. But actually, you are again. If one is proud, one is going against reality. So you will feel naturally the short-circuiting. Not because, again, there is some enemy outside. Technically speaking, there are no enemies outside. If you perceive an enemy, it's just Atmavan manjati jagat, say the Veda. Atmavan manjati jagat means whatever you have in your inner world, you are projecting that into the outer world. We are seeing that with the gopis in the Venu Gita. As we mentioned, the exact opposite of this. They are seeing everyone has devotion except me. So Deutam Bhakta, Deutam Bhagavat, the greatest devotee, in one sense, it's not discriminating. It's in everyone has love for Krishna, but it has some discrimination. Everyone has love for Krishna, except for me. So there is some discrimination. But someone with pride generally will try to not acknowledge the causes even of one's success, because one can get some success. One can be able of having some skills, and that's a fact, and one should acknowledge those in order to engage them in seva. But the point is, I mean, if I am really sober, I will understand I'm able to reach this particular goal, to express this particular virtue, because of so many elements that are beyond my will. I mean, Krishna in the Gita, when he analyzes the factor for action, he mentions the jiva's free will, but he mentions many other elements as showing you are not the only doer. Now, that's the very idea of false ego, ahamkara. Ahamkara means I am the one who is doing the whole thing. I am the one leading the show. It all depends on me. And no, it's not. There are so many factors creating influences in between. Now, we are one of them, but we are part of a bigger picture again. So to acknowledge the things is humbling. And again, it's not a problem. Pride still thinks that it's a problem to be humble, basically. No? It still means if one remains proud, means one has not fully understood humility. Because if you really understand humility, you will embrace that completely. You will understand its virtues, its pros, its advantages, its beauty, and you are not losing anything for being humble, actually. Of course, the problem is sometimes in our DNA, there are even so many unconscious layers of misunderstood humility, misapplied humility, and in the name of humility, you became basically manipulated and abused and exploited, or people use the term to take advantage of others. And we are in an environment in this world where pride is a must for you to be someone in the world. Somehow you have to, as Guru Maharaj will say, you have to step on others' head. And Mahaprabhu is asking, let your head being stepped on by, in one sense. Now you have to understand the notion. So it may take some time to process, to digest, because it's so much, like, not inherent, but so much inside the discourse that we may receive from day one in this lifetime, in this world, about how to be someone in this life. And maybe they won't speak in terms of pride, but pride is injected in the equation in so many of those ideas. For you to be someone, you need to be like this, you need to act like this, you need to feel like this, you need to relate to others like this, and this. So it's a whole process to deconstruct all those, like, expressions of pride that may be there in our psyche, that we do not see that they are pride, basically. And what to speak again of all the four forms of pride that come in the disguise of bhakti. Because again, someone asked Guru Maharaj how to deal with pride, something similar. And he said, well, if you really understand the as a bhakta and in bhakti, and say, oh, if you really understand the nature of bhakti, you will see, you will really realize there's no reason to be proud, because bhakti is a gift. So a gift means you don't deserve it, but still you have it. So whatever comes from that undeserved gift is equally undeserved, but necessary. We need it. We don't deserve it. We need it. We have not made enough merit to deserve it, but we are desperate in need of that. So that's coming graciously. So if you understand how these things work on a basic level, you have no reason to be proud. Because your pride is, I did it. It's my merit. It's my, I'm the cause. Okay, you want to be the cause? There comes the effect. Cause, effect, karma. That's why sometimes we cannot remain for too long under the shelter of causeless mercy. Because it's too much for our ego to live constantly with the notion that whatever is coming, I haven't done anything to deserve that. It's too much for the ego sometimes. The ego wants to deserve something at one point. So we go out of the circle, protective circle of causeless mercy, and enter into the cause and effect circle. So you can feel, I did it, I deserve it. Even though it comes as a big headache at the end, but I deserve it. I'm behind it. Which is, again, it's not real either in that case. In that case, you are only part of the equation. So I will say in brief words, just to wrap up and continue with another question, because of course we can speak for eternity about this, and we should. Because there are so many, it's a constant topic of conversation about how its pride appears and expresses in all different stages. And we should develop an organ to perceive that. No, I mean, if we should be willing, again, as I mentioned, to engage in a daily recognition, a daily research of how pride is choosing to visit me today. If one day has passed and you have not done that work, most probably pride has won that battle that day. It's a little bit more inside of you, and you are not recognizing that. So the more pride advances and you allow that without concerning for recognizing, the more it will be difficult for you when you want to recognize it, to recognize it. You follow? If you let that element to enter, and you don't care for acknowledging, ascertaining what is that, whenever you say, well, now I want to ascertain what is that, after years of not moving a finger for that. So it will be difficult. More difficult. So I would say, like Guru Maharaj also mentions, one of the important points to continue to always remain humble, or try to, is to be willing to learn. Being willing to learn, being willing to... And learn doesn't mean just, I will sit for Guru Maharaj's class. I mean, you can make a show sitting in Guru Maharaj's class. It's easy to learn only in that way. I sit, I learn, I take notes, I smile, and then what? What do I do with that class? How do I transport the class into my daily life, into my inner, into my relationships again? Or like I see you, sometimes I enter and all of you fall to the ground. It's quite shocking for me, but what to do? So, and I have no problem. I mean, I'm not saying stop doing that. But the point is, hopefully you are doing that from a natural, voluntary, nourishing way, because if not, the last thing I would like is to see you doing all that domino effect show, basically. Because, I mean, it's not helping me. It's not helping you, it's not helping me, therefore. No? I mean, it's not that I need a bunch of people falling to the ground every time I enter a room. If I will need that, I'm in a serious case. No? No? But if that's done from a proper place, from humility, and you feel, okay, Maharaj, I received something from Maharaj, and acknowledge that, I feel fortunate for that, and I would like to honor that by putting my head to the ground, showing my gratitude and affection. If that's the background, then that's committing me towards each of the person doing that and increasing my humility and relationship. But if that's not there, it's just like harming to each other in the name of Panchakalpa Tarubhyascha. So similar, in the name of everything, here in a class or whatever, we can be doing harm or promoting pride also. Sometimes you can fall immediately to the ground, so Maharaj is pleased with me and doesn't say anything to me. Because he will feel, oh, he's so surrendered, he's so humble. But that's not necessarily only humility. Humility takes so many forms, as pride takes so many forms. Again, one may seem the other and vice versa. Like Guru Maharaj always speaks, he's a very confident person, our Guru Maharaj. And sometimes that being confident may be mistaken with being proud. If you don't understand the underlying background, you may feel, oh, that's too bold. But what's the background of that? And again, the opposite. Someone may just do a show of daily pranam, and every time she sees you, it seems like he's melting. But it may be just a very, even unconscious, without bad intention, but unconscious strategy to remain like an ideal, humble person, so the person doesn't say anything and doesn't penetrate that layer that I'm trying to put. No? It seems humble, but I'm actually trying to say to that person, do not dare enter in beyond this. Again, maybe I'm not aware of that, but maybe I'm resorting to that pranam mudra as a barrier. It's a protective circle. Please, nobody enters here. No. But if we think like that, well, we are not understanding too much what's bhakti about. It's a pretty relational project. And we project to live for eternity in community. Golok Vrindavan is not me in my whatever. In my flat, and somehow when Krishna plays the flute, I run from my sofa and meet him and return when I want. It's not like that. It's totally relational, and you're living with so many people. Of course, everyone there is totally transcendental, and in that sense you won't have certain issues that you may have here as a sadhaka, but you will never get there if you do not go through those issues as a sadhaka here. So I will say that it's very important to voluntarily expose ourselves to relationships to see where we are, to be more realistic about what we are and what we want to be. And of course, to relationships in this case, I mean not to any person, because you can expose to weird, to crazy people, and you will receive a particular feedback that may not be the more enlightening. But if you remain close to people that you trust, that they have well-wishing on you, and they have some vision and knowledge to guide you, and that will give you a good example of what to do. Well, that's beautiful, and that's challenging, because again, that creates a constant contrast that you have to know how to deal with. Because if you are closer to a person who is more advanced, naturally you will realize that you are not that advanced. And it's okay. No? And hopefully that more advanced person is telling you it's okay. No? It's not telling you you are less advanced, I'm more advanced. That's not how it works. If that person is more advanced, the more advanced person will delight in seeing a less advanced person being willing to be more advanced. Like a teacher seeing a sincere student wanting to grow, and the teacher will be so much delighted and compassionate and investing himself on that person and wanting that person to see that person grow and reach a very bright future. So that's how it works. No? That's the type of guidance we should take. It's not just like a dictatorship and something that is like crushing our psyche or something like that. But it's good that we expose ourselves to those personalities, and we are willing to hear what they have to share with us and what happened in us in the proximity of those personalities. No, don't be afraid of that. Do not escape from that. And if we feel, I'm terrified about all that you are saying, Maharaj, okay, no problem, I believe you. So then the next question is why? Not why I'm terrified. Because I have nothing against any of you. I'm trying to hopefully be compassionate and serve you. But we may feel sometimes I'm terrified by that proposal. So what's in me that makes me feel terrified? And that's the whole process of introspection and contemplation that we have to constantly engage into to maintain ourselves in Krishna consciousness. You won't maintain yourself practicing bhakti if you don't have that, how to say, that, yeah, if you don't establish, you don't get accustomed to coexist with yourself in that dynamic. Because you have to live with yourself. I mean, you have to live with others, but also you have to live with yourself. So if there's no transparency and willing to learn and willing to change, well, nobody can do anything, basically. We have to do the part. So pride, yeah, it's there in many ways. But sometimes also some things may happen which are not necessarily pride. So sometimes be careful also not to over-ascribe pride to anything that's happening. No? Sometimes some people may be, I don't know, weak emotionally and need to be like reaffirmed in their own personality by the environment, and have constantly people like telling them, well done, you are great. You can call that pride if you want, but maybe that's more of a fragile self-confidence that needs to be strengthened. No? That you don't need constantly an environment saying to you Kijai for you to be someone. No? Because that can happen, again, in the context of bhakti. You may get addicted to recognition, to positioning, and that's not necessary. You know? One should develop oneself internally in such a way that, as Guru Maharaj, I think, he spoke today, you know, about how we do not care that much about recognition from the world, but recognition from the world, Krishna and the people who really are well-wishers and sage, who really know what's best for us and who we are, and so on. So, anyhow, maybe I didn't say one single thing, but share some ideas to hopefully think about, and yeah. Gayatri had a question?
Yes, thank you. It's about the Vaina Gita. If I remember correctly, you said that the gopis married some cowherd boys. And also that the husbands of the gopis don't like Krishna. And they can't even stand the gopis breathing in their direction. How is it possible for the coward boys to not like Krishna?
Actually, that's how the gopis experience the situation themselves, subjectively. For them, it's just like, again, and it's difficult to fully and grasp that if we are not there on that level, how this operates. You know, how when you love Krishna as passionately as the gopis do, whatever element seems to not fully accompany that is perceived as a, again, it's funny because it seems something like what we were speaking before, but in the other side, in this world, like if someone is not like, agreeing with you in something, you may feel, oh, they're against me, or whatever. You may project a false sense of enmity towards the environment. But of course, in the context of Maya Shakti, the concept of false ego. Here the gopis are fully under the fold of the Sarup Shakti. They are made of Prem, basically, mostly, all of them. But somehow they see something like that, no? I mean, whatever gets in the way of us and Krishna is perceived as a worst possible monster. Sometimes it's the husband, sometimes they're in-laws, sometimes it's whatever it may be, whatever form it takes. A piece of wood that falls on the path. I mean, it's not something regarding the husbands in itself or like someone in particular, but it's how, actually it speaks not so much about how bad their husbands are, because as you mentioned, they are gopas, and it's not that in Golok Vrindavan there are some people who is bad or is against Krishna. Actually, everyone loves Krishna there. Even Jatila, Kutila, all that seem the one to seem to who seem to be the bad guys in the movie, or Chandravali, the archie rival, you say in English, of Sri Radha. Actually, they are cousin sisters, and they love each other. But for particular reasons, to increase the dynamics of the Leela and the love of Sri Radha and so on, Chandravali, appears. I think I read with you, we shared this in the Venu Gita, maybe in some other series, I cannot recall, maybe it was the Brahma Gita. I think it was Brahma Gita. At one point when Sri Radha is about to leave her body in separation from Krishna, I think it was when Krishna returns to Vrindavan in his Mathura, and in the expansion that went out to Mathura and Dwarka, and he returns to Vrindavan. This is narrated by the Goswamis. And Sri Radha is just about to leave her body. And all of the so-called bad guys or girls in the movie, Chandravali, Jatila, Kutila, all of them fall at the feet of Sri Radha in that moment when she's about to pass away. And they start to cry and to acknowledge, actually, you are the greatest, you are the... They all start to show their actual, real, deep appreciation for her and deep feelings for her. And Chandravali the same. No, whatever I've done with Krishna is only to show the greatness of your love so you can enter into man, into this jealous mood and all this. I was only used as a puppet for that. I'm nobody. So they really feel like that. But in the dynamic of the Leela, Yogamaya makes arrangement for them to act in another way that seems proud, that seems that they dislike Krishna, they are enemies, but they are just nourishing the situation, nourishing the love in the whole of Raj. So it's more like of a functional thing, no? They operate on a certain level, apparently on some level, it appears to be that, but again, when the moment of reality comes, all of them show how much love they have for both of them. So this same thing applies to the gopis' husbands. I mean, you cannot enter Vrindavan without loving Krishna. So So the gopis, when they say that, they mostly express that in the context of their... Instead of speaking about the husbands, they are actually speaking, showing how much longing they have to meet Krishna, how much whatever it gets in the way of that, they perceive as the greatest tragedy. But the result of that perception is like their love escalates to newer and newer dimensions. So, phalena pharishyate, you are to judge a tree by its fruits. No? So what's the result? Because if you say, oh, the gopis are just blaming the whole environment, they are projecting their own bias to everyone in Vrindavan, they are feeling they are enemies, you could even present the argument. They are committing Vaishnava parad because they are offending many Brajavasis. But what's the fruit of acting in that way? That the Krishna prema escalates like nothing. So you judge the tree by its fruit. So if the fruit is that the gopis' love is growing more and more, it means that the method, if you will, by which that love get there is, there is something to be considered. So again, it's just a way of them expressing their intense longing. And we have to learn from that. Of course, when you really love something, someone, and you really, specifically in the Bhagavad Gita, which we are speaking in terms of Purva Rag, try to imagine, you love someone, but you have never met that person yet. You have never fully acknowledged that love for that person. It's only some glances and some written messages, and everything is like growing in momentum for that moment, but it's not happening. But you are getting closer for that to happen, so that increases the, how do you say, like expectancy? Well, expectation, that will happen, So it's just about to happen and something gets in the way. It's like, you feel that's like, and maybe that's not too much if you see it without, from outside, like a detached emotional perspective. You are exaggerating. You don't have to speak like this to your husband about your husband. But we don't understand. We have to enter to what the gopis are feeling and how much they are dying in separation. They just like cannot but think about when that day will be mine. And that's a lesson for us regarding longing, which of course it may be something that still is not to be that much cultivated, since first we have to cultivate other elements for longing to be something realistic. First it has to be some other elements in place, but nonetheless they are showing us the price to pay. You want union with Krishna? You want to participate eternally in his divine play? Okay. You want to transcend the forest fire of samsara? Okay. You want to enter into another forest fire called viraha, separation from Krishna. That burns. Burns. All the things that, try to imagine if at this present moment someone deprives you of everything that you consider dear and near apart from Krishna, how you may feel. You will maybe burn alive. So the gopis are teaching us, okay, that fire has to be gradually, but you have to learn how to direct that to Krishna. Because the gopis lost everything else. They are willing to lose everything, but they are burning only for Krishna. They are not burning for house, family, possessions. I mean, they forgot about that. They're only burning, their flame is exclusively burning. It's not a flame, again, it's a forest fire. But it's exclusively burning in one single condensed direction. In our case, we are still not that fortunate because we burn in different directions, not only for Krishna. And that's why for Krishna there is some flame, and we have to learn how to make that flame epidemic. And for that we have to put the other flames in that direction as well. But it's a gradual process. But they are teaching to us that as well. So with some real love for Krishna is coming, some real emotion, deep emotion, we won't be able to tolerate the minimum interruption of that. For example, one of the nine qualities of someone in Bhava Bhakti, someone who has awakened to the reality of ecstatic love, someone for whom ecstasy is the norm, in trying to imagine a deep constant internal emotion for Krishna is the norm, one of the nine symptoms is abhyartha kalatvam. Abhyartha kalatvam for us may seem like neurosis, but for them is, I mean, the most obvious, natural, spontaneous response, which is unwillingness to spoil even 1 second without being able to serve Krishna. That 1 second spoil is felt like the most tragic loss or something. But in a natural way, again, they are not like psychologically dysfunctional, take it easy, no problem, life goes on. And of course, they are not losing their time, even in a second. It's not they are doing that, and every time they do that, I lose another second in Bhakti. I mean, you are a Bhava Bhakta. you are in that, but that's the point, is that's their disposition, that's their willingness. They do not want to lose even 1 second in something unrelated with Krishna. For us, that seems, they are fanatics. But they are not fanatics. Or they are fanatics in a healthy way, if you will. If you want to, we can speak about healthy fanaticism. But they love Krishna, basically, and they cannot just live without him, think without him, feel without him. I mean, he's in the equation in every place they see, they think, they feel. He's totally integrated into their lives. So, I mean, they are not willing to renounce that. They are not willing to live for a nanosecond without that. And for us, that sounds extreme. Wow. We need that to happen yet in our case, unfortunately. Still, I need to take a rest from the Holy Name. I need to take a rest from Harikatha. I need to take a rest from proximity to the sadhus. I need to have my moment, my time, my maya, I'm a meti. I need to caress a little bit my sense of self-conceiving connection to what I think it belongs to me. For a while, Maharaj, for a while. Be merciful. What's mercy? Again, this is a gradual process, and we cannot just finish that from day 12, one day to another. But as Guru Maharaj say, we have to be at least have the dignity and integrity to accept the facts and how things are, and how we should be working in certain things in a certain way, and how if we are not addressing those issues, we cannot expect that they will be solved magically, because that's not bhakti. It's not magic. Maya Shakti is magic, in the sense of that you think things will happen magically by not doing what you have to do. That means you are under the spell of Maya, and that's one of the meaning of close proximity. The term Maya, magic, they are quite close. But bhakti is no. I don't want magic. I mean, I want reality, things as they are. And I know that I have to do certain things for some things to happen. Again, it's not that everything depends on me, but at the same time, some part I have to do for the other things that are beyond my scope to manifest in my life, and for me to appreciate those things that are beyond me. Because causeless grace, causeless mercy is so needed, and it will come. But if I'm not doing my homework, I won't be able to recognize causeless mercy coming to my life. So I won't be able to acknowledge that. And I will be all only willing to accept what sometimes is called sakata kripa, although that may seem as an oxymoron, which means sakata kripa, sakapata kripa. Yeah. Nishkapata and sakapata. Yeah. Which is mercy with cheating and mercy without cheating. No? Of course, it's a way of expressing, because if you say mercy, how mercy can imply cheating? No? But the point is, it's a way of saying, again, no? The famous example is Duryodhana with Balaram. There's one devotee wrote an interesting article some time back, Madhavanandapu, on how if you study the relationship between Balaram and Duryodhana, it seems that Balaram was quite biased towards Duryodhana. And it seems like, what? I mean, Duryodhana was considered a partial expansion of the age of Kali Yuga, basically. Try to imagine Kali Yuga personified. that's not exciting. And on the other side, you have Balaram, who is the personification of so many things, including Guru Tattva, and apparently being like quite merciful to Duryodhana. There are many instances, I won't enter into the details now. But if you analyze those in detail, you will realize that Balaram was actually not bestowing his mercy on Duryodhana. He was, and I wouldn't say he was cheating him, but actually Duryodhana was cheated, not by Balaram, but by his own approach to Balaram. Balaram just reacted as he could according to how the other person approached. So it's like if you approach your guru and you are not too sincere and you are not too willing to surrender nor too willing to accept, to change, to be instructed. But at the same time you approach and you ask Gurudev something. But you present your request in such a way that you don't give your guru basically any option. Basically you already gave him the solution to your problem and whatever, and you are almost telling him what he has to tell you, basically. So your guru will recognize, well, this disciple is not to surrender, and if I say something beyond what he is expecting, that person may get lost totally. So at least that person remains on some level connected, and I basically tell him whatever he wants to hear. And one could say, oh, the guru is cheating the disciple. No, he's not cheating the disciple. He's seeing the disciple is not willing to hear more, so he's just and trying from that place to somehow maintain the person with some level of connection that may give some benefit for eventually creating more willingness to hear. But again, the guru is not cheating. The disciple is cheating himself by approaching the guru with that attitude. You follow my point? Mm-hmm. So, of course, we don't want that. And it's important to be willing to surrender, again, to guru, to Vaishnavas. Again, it's not an imposition. So that's the beauty of surrender, no? That you choose to do that. And you have concluded, you have thought about that, and you have concluded why that's the best thing you can do. And of course, surrender is a word that we need to think about a lot, because who knows what you think about when I say surrender. Again, some DNA may explode there, which is not the most healthy one. So, but surrender is basically the natural response to someone who is already surrendered. And it's giving himself, herself so much to you that just the only natural, like in a natural way, the only way you could possibly reciprocate to that. If you meet someone who gives himself, herself to you fully, I mean, you start to realize I cannot pay back to this person with money, with external things, I want to pay in the same currency. That may take the form of money and other things if surrender is there. If surrender is not there, a surrendered person won't want that money or anything. The person wants to surrender, but it may take different. But it's important that we are after mercy without cheating, basically, what we were speaking before. Real mercy is therefore helping us to transcend all forms of cheating. Gradually, but consistently. The two things have to be there. No? Sometimes you say, the process is gradual. I mean, it's as gradual as you want to make it gradual. I mean, it's not that gradual either. I mean, if you want to make it last 16,108 lifetimes, okay, you can do it. But if you can make it last 3 lifetimes, again, we are not in a marathon, as long, but the point is, gradually, some longing has to be there. So we will want to increase the quality of our surrender. I think today also Guru Maharaj was speaking about that. No, like we have to pay attention to the quality of our practice and trying to improve that. The other day, one devotee was asking Guru Maharaj, Anurag Prabhu. We were having prasad here. Those are some of the Guru Maharaj make a question, very valid one. He asks Guru Maharaj, are you working on some project now? And Guru Maharaj replied, on myself.
Yeah.
So I felt that's why I chose him to be my Guru Maharaj. Yeah. Because you could possibly reply in so many ways to that question, which is okay. Also, you can reply in the other ways. It's not, he could have said, I'm finishing my book and this, and it's okay. But he made a case. No? So he said, I'm working on myself. I think that's enough project. No? Like making a point. No? Like I said, told you the other day when I was in Vrindavan and I asked him, Guru Maharaj in Vrindavan, you want that I bring you something from Vrindavan? He told me Prem. Mm. That was the only word in the reply in the mail. Bring me Prem. Okay. And you have to think about that. It's not just, oh, how nice Gurudev, his transcendental replies. And just you continue with your life and say, no, I mean, what does it mean for me? Because he gave me an instruction. I have to bring him Prem. I don't have Prem. But he gave the instruction. So how do I make this instruction real? Maybe not in this visit in Vrindavan, but how do I get closer to making that request real? Or the same thing. Which is your project? Myself. Okay. How much do I think in those same terms? My guru thinking like that. I hope I'm following his footsteps. Not imitating, but I should be working on my project. But how much my project is the priority project or other projects that are for fostering another sense of myself, no? Which is the priority project in my life. I mean, when he said I'm working on myself, you can imagine what he meant by myself, no? And what he meant by working on that myself. So of course, I felt it like a totally like, oof, immediate commitment. No? Like, I mean, that was for me. I mean, he replied to Anurag, but whoever was listening, you kind of say, it was for him. No, I should be working on myself, and I should make... And that's not a selfish thing, because if you really understand who you are in connection to your source, there's no place for selfishness in that project. So we should be willing to identify with that project. That's the point. Identification with priority. Whatever is your priority in life, you identify with that and you become that. That's who you think you are. That's whom you identify with instinctively. How you feel you are. Who you feel you are. I mean, you can only reply to that yourself. Who do you feel you are in the most priority-like way? There you have where you are. Standing on the journey. And again, not to feel bad, just to be willing to acknowledge the facts and do the needful to progress further. To live our life in such a way that when we ask ourselves who I am, in a natural way comes who I really am and all that I can be in connection to bhakti as a unit of a dedicating unit and for the pleasure of our guardians. That's who we are in the most real sense of the term. And so many ideas of who we are just upadis, limiting adjuncts or false designations. And again, we may entertain them for a while, we may balance them for being functional on the world, but at the end of the day, they are here today, gone tomorrow, as Guru Maharaj will say. So our school is not renunciation, but there is a type of renunciation, for sure. Particularly Asya Bharjanam. You have to renounce everything that is unfavorable to bhakti. You don't need to be officially a sannyasi renunciant to engage in that renunciation. All of us have to engage in that equally. It's not that, oh, you are a sannyasi, you have that color, you have to engage more in renunciation. No, I just have this clothes because whatever. That's my nature, no? That's an ashram in which I fit according to my acquired nature. That's all. I mean, do not make a big show out of that. But the real devotional renunciation, all of us have to engage in that equally. It's not that angry has to have a license to not embrace Anuprathikulya Savarjanam that much. That's cheating. Everyone, all of us have to reject all that is unfavorable for bhakti. So do not cheat ourselves with that. No? So, and accepting all that is favorable. And again, hopefully what I'm saying is like honey to your ears. Because that's how it should be. And if that's not happening, no problem. Let's be realistic. But it's nice to then to ask ourselves, while I do not feel fully at home with some of these concepts. And it's okay. I mean, again, do not feel guilt or shame because of that. I mean, it happens to all of us. Be careful to isolate yourself in these situations and thinking, oh, I'm the only one feeling, I don't know, that I don't have a taste for that type of renunciation. No, everyone is going through the same stages. And everyone has to. Not matter. If you take a plane and you go to Radhakunda and you are someone, give me Siddha Pranali, and you are now such and such Manjari, blah, blah, blah. Still, you have to go through all those same things I'm speaking today. It's not that you can avoid that by some particular device or something. I mean, still, if you are in an Artani Vritti, you are in an Artani Vritti with Manjari name or without Manjari name. I mean, it doesn't change. No, as Guru Maharaj said today, that's a detail. The important thing is the integrity of our approach to the ideal. No? The dignity of our acceptance of who we are and who we want to be. That's what it means to be sincere. I mean, we want to be sincere. If you are not sincere, it doesn't work. If you are sincere, it works perfectly. Even in the most disastrous days of your life. I mean, no problem. I mean, the real disaster is not to be sincere. That's the problem. All the things are not disaster. Are not problem. Just remain sincere. And I remember one quote, but I think it was Charles Chaplin. He said something like, "Try to be happy and be sincere, but above all, try to be sincere." Like implying the other thing may come, may not come. I mean, the happiness is not the goal of life, technically speaking. The goal of life is purpose, meaning, artha in Sanskrit, artha. And our last goal is panchama purushartha, prem. Prem means full meaning, full purpose. It doesn't mean you are happy. Of course you are happy, but you don't care for that. You care for purpose. I mean, some situation comes to your life and you are suffering. It's not just, I want to be happy, I want to be happy, I want to be happy. No, find purpose in whatever is happening. That's the real thing, not just be happy. That's a superficial thing, just running for stop suffering. Everyone is doing that in this world, trying to take shelter in pleasure to avoid suffering, but finding no real deep purpose into things. So, bhakti is the ultimate purpose to everything. So we have to be concerned about that. No? There are different days in our struggle as sadhaka, so do not let the day pass without you being able to extract purpose from that. That's only, the lost day is the one that you have not extract proper purpose from that. It's not the day that happened everything in the perfect place and ecstatic and nice. I mean, generally the contrary, the most chaotic days are the ones you can draw the most. Again, see Bhagavad Gita, see Srimad Bhagavatam. I mean, that's not the perfect scenario. You will die in 7 days. I mean, it's not what you expect. No? Kill all your relatives. Try to understand the implication. I'm Christian. It's not the classical scenario. Like, okay, I mean, study life of Mahaprabhu also. No? I mean, his father died as a child. His first wife died. He got married very soon, and eventually he took sannyas. So, but You have to be able to draw purpose. So do not let any day pass without that. I always like what Prabhupada says. He says, before you go, when you are going to sleep, before falling asleep, try to think about your whole day. And try to... He didn't say with those words, but basically he was saying that. Try to extract purpose from your day before going to sleep. If not, you are just maybe being a machine and going through the motions. And that can happen. Niyama graha. You get accustomed to do stuff in a mechanical way. You don't have a clue why the hell you are doing that. And it's dangerous because it can happen in bhakti. Because every day you chant the same mantra, you worship the same deity, you read the same book. Same, quote unquote. It's never the same, but it can remain the same if you remain on the superficial platform of that. So you have to go to pierce that layer with insights about purpose. So do not let any day pass without finding meaning. What can I learn from today? Which was the lesson? If it's helpful, write about that, whatever, it helps you the most. No? But, because if not, what's the meaning? One more day, and which was the purpose today? Second day, you may get accustomed to that, and whole life pass, and you know, that much purpose. So that can happen. We have that potential. Brightest potential, darkest potential. So we are here to embrace our brightest potential. So let's try to follow that together. So. Anyhow, that's in connection with the husbands of the gopis also, somehow. I trust you will be able to connect the dots there. So, I think we are almost ready for prasad, so we can leave it here and meet very soon for some other lectures. Thank you so much for your time. Srila Gurudev ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Sri Sri Dauji Gopal ki jai, Kalsi Brat ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanand.